Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 5th of January. The first hour of our program today, we talk about the filibuster. The new Senate will be voting on, and there is some speculation that it will be they'll be voting on this in the opening hours today of their new session. It's a vote on whether to change the rules to prohibit the widespread use of the filibuster. The filibuster, we're going to learn all about it this hour of the program, and I think that many of us are interested in the history of the filibuster. Nothing in Article 1 of the Constitution permits the Senate to insist on a supermajority for regular legislation. The drafters were quite specific about which acts needed supermajority approval. Section 7 requires a two-thirds vote to override a presidential veto. Article 2, Section 2 calls for the approval of two-thirds of the senators for treaties the president has entered into. And Article 5 requires a two-thirds vote to propose a constitutional amendment. So why have we in recent times governed from the idea that you need to have 60 votes for any legislation to proceed? Every returning Democrat has signed a letter demanding an end to the almost automatic way the filibuster has been used in recent years. By simply raising an anonymous objection, senators can trigger a 60-vote supermajority for virtually every piece of legislation. This is a contentious issue. There are, of course, many who say that if you're in power, then you are concerned about the filibuster. If you're not in power, if you're not in power, you are concerned about it. If you're in power, you're concerned about it. It changes with whoever happens to hold the power in Washington. And the Democrats would be more concerned about it now. But if they should lose their power in Washington, then the Republicans, if they take over, would be more concerned about it. So that's where we stand this hour. And we'll have a lot of questions to be answered about the historical use. We have the perfect guest for this discussion, because he's written a book about the historical use of the filibuster. Gregory Warro is our guest. Professor Warro specializes in American politics, including Congress, elections, campaign finance, and political economy and political methodology. He is the author of Filibuster, Obstruction and Lawmaking in the United States Senate. He's associate professor of political science at Columbia University. Our phone number for you to join this conversation is 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, and we already have some Facebook questions, so we'll get to those as we go through this hour. Professor Gregory Warro, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
First, just to get an idea of what's happening today, will the Senate be voting on this afternoon?
It's not clear that they will actually vote on it. There's a couple different things that are happening. There's the attempt by some junior senators led by Mark Udall to try to employ what's known as the constitutional option, or more colorfully as the nuclear option, to try to change the Senate rules without having to invoke cloture on a resolution to change the Senate rules. Harry Reid and Republican leaders have been working on a potential compromise package that would preempt that effort, making some changes to the rules regarding filibusters, probably not going as far as the junior Democrats would like to see, but they may basically forestall the attempt to change more profoundly the filibuster rules in the Senate. And it's not clear if those compromises are going to be worked out in time for them to do it today.
I see. Have Republicans been bringing more filibusters in the last couple of years than Democrats brought in the previous two terms of the Bush administration?
That's the claim that Democrats have certainly made. And there is some systematic evidence to back that up. One problem is it's tough to measure a filibuster, especially the way that they're conducted today, because you don't actually have to take the floor like you used to have to do Mr. Smith style. and hold it for extended periods. Basically, you can filibuster just by threatening to filibuster. And so how we keep track of the number of filibusters is a little obscure where the numbers actually come from. But there, the Congressional Research Service has put together some data. There's some other political scientists who have put together data, and it definitely looks like they are using the filibuster more and more. This has been a trend that started back in the late 60s, early 70s, and it's been steadily increasing. Although by the numbers that are available, it looks like the trend has accelerated in its pace over the past especially in the last Congress.
Why don't you have to take the floor? Our images of, you know, Barney Frank or Jimmy Stewart, certainly, who just took the floor and kept talking and talking and talking. Why wouldn't you have to take the floor?
This is basically how the Senate has evolved with respect to filibusters. Basically, since the 1980s, we really have not had the kind of knockdown, drag-out fights where senators take the floor, they bring in the cots, and they stay,
right.
Stay in session for over the weekend and at night through the night and all that. Basically, so my take on this is that the Senate cannot afford to fight filibuster battles like this. I refer to them in the book with Eric Schickler as wars of attrition. Basically, the majority is trying to wait out the minority and basically just wear them down. But nowadays, the Senate has such a full agenda, and senators' personal schedules are so tightly packed that they essentially can't afford to spend hours and hours on the floor debating these issues and trying to basically the minority and the majority trying to wear each other out like they used to do in the 1930s, 40s, up through the 1960s at least. So it's really a statement about how the Senate has evolved as an institution and the demands that are placed on the Senate's floor time and on individual senators' schedules. So senators basically don't want to be on the floor. They want to be heading back to their states to interact with their constituents. They want to be on the phone, going through their Rolodexes, trying to raise money for their next re-election fight.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really just a statement about what life is like today for a senator.
Are filibusters one of the reasons that so many judicial nominations haven't been brought to a vote?
There have been a number of things that have contributed to that. I think there's convincing evidence that that filibusters have made it harder to get individuals confirmed. That's not the only thing though. There is, I think, the vetting processes now for nominees are much more thorough, and that takes time. And so, but part of this is endogenous, right, in the sense that the reason that the vetting process is so thorough now is because if something comes up about a nominee, then the nominee is likely to get filibustered. If you look at the history of the confirmation process, really until the past decade, you have not seen the level of conflict over judicial nominees that we saw during the Bush administration, particularly when Bill Frist was majority leader and they were contemplating changing the filibuster rules with respect to nominees back then. If you look at confirmation battles prior to that, you know, there really wasn't much of a fight there for most of these nominees. Most of them got through on a voice vote or had well above the 60 vote threshold that you would need to invoke cloture on a nominee. It seems like there is more controversy, though, in terms of placing holds on nominees. And holds, basically, in my view, are just threats to filibuster. I don't believe that senators can unilaterally hold up an individual if there is widespread support for that individual. I think an individual senator can make it a lot harder to get that individual confirmed, but I don't think that senators actually do have a unilateral veto. I think that's been somewhat overstated in the media and by senators themselves in terms of what kinds of powers that they have. But there is no doubt that confirmation battles have become more controversial and that filibusters are playing a more prominent role in these confirmation fights. But at the same time, I think we need to be a little bit careful about just asserting that the filibuster is the sole cause of the problems that have existed with nominees not getting through.
Uh-huh. Considering the fact that nothing in Article 1 of the Constitution permits the Senate to insist on this supermajority for every bit of legislation, when did we get it and why? Does it go way back in history?
Not really. It's a characteristic of the modern Senate, really, since the 1970s. If you look back into the 19th century, when the Senate did not have a cloture rule at all, the Senate had no provision in its rules, basically, for ending debate and bringing items to an up or down vote. In the 19th century, the Senate was a fairly majoritarian body. So if you consider that the Senate did not have a cloture rule in the 19th century, if you look at that from the modern perspective of today's Senate, you would think, how did they get anything done, right? Because basically, right, it seems like you would need unanimity to get anything passed, right? To get anything to an up or down vote and enact it. But the perception of the legitimacy of the filibuster was very different in the 19th century and throughout a good part of the 20th century as well. It was just not viewed as a legitimate tactic for senators to use. And so you see that the Senate operated pretty efficiently as a majoritarian body. There were some major filibuster battles that led people to conclude that the Senate was essentially a unanimous institution, that individual senators had a liberum veto like existed in the Polish parliament, where a single senator could say no and something would not pass. But the systematic evidence does not support that not support that claim at all. Once we get into the 20th century, and the Senate adopts a cloture rule in 1917, where you need two-thirds to end debate and bring something to a vote, you still do not see that being used regularly. It's true that coalition sizes did increase, and there's some debate over what caused that increase. Was it the cloture rule itself, or was it the character of legislation that the Senate was considering at that time? But you still see lots of legislation passing with simple majorities, even after the Senate adopts a two-thirds cloture rule. During the filibuster battles of the 1940s through the 1960s, where the filibuster really became front and center, it started to be ingrained in the public conscience that this was a central feature of the Senate, it was still not viewed as a legitimate tactic. And even Southerners who were relying on it heavily had questions about whether or not this was something that they should have been doing. It's not until you get to the 1970s, really, that senators start to accept this as a regular way of doing business in their institution. And in the 70s, the number of filibusters starts to increase. The quality of filibusters starts to change somewhat, in the sense that they're using it on a wider array of legislative issues. And really, then when you get into the 1990s and into the first decade of the 20th century, it really takes off, in the sense that it's accepted among senators that essentially they live in a super majoritarian institution. We call it the 60-vote Senate now, where it's unlikely that anything is going to get passed or even get close to the floor if it's not clear that you have a 60-vote majority to be able to invoke cloture on it.
And early on, what were the philosophical reasons for it to be not considered legitimate?
Well, that the Senate had this reputation of being the greatest debating body in the world, right? And so senators closely guarded their rights to speak at length on whatever issues they thought were important, but that was balanced with recognition that the majority rules, and so the term filibuster itself comes from it's a reference to pirates.
Really?
So right. So filibustero. It's a reference to pirates in the Caribbean. The term wasn't coined until the end of the 19th century, and didn't enter into the common parlance until really the 20th century. But that gives you an idea of how it was viewed back then. That this was essentially these were individuals of questionable integrity who were hijacking the legislative process, and that's how they were. So the term filibusters really taps into that. another interesting thing is in the 19th and, 20, and early 20th century, senators are accused of filibustering, and they vehemently deny that they are filibustering, whereas nowadays senators take pride in the fact that they are filibustering. So back then it was just, you know, it was not an accepted part of the legislative process, that it was viewed as an illegitimate way to try to accomplish your goals.
Interesting. And tell me how the filibuster was used and whether or not it became more in fashion because people realized how they could block legislation during the civil rights legislation.
So in the era of civil rights reform, the filibuster is used. It starts to be used on some anti-lynching measures in the 20s and 30s. But the curious thing about that is there actually were cloture votes on some of those measures, but they didn't even have simple majorities voting in favor of the cloture motions. And so it doesn't, you know, there's some evidence that basically, early on, the filibuster was not killing some of these civil rights measures, that it was, that there were larger issues at stake here, that where they were not able to put together supermajority coalitions to vote for something that seemed like it would be a no-brainer, like let's end lynching in the South. But once we get into the 40s, it's clear that Southerners are going to make this a central part of their strategy to try to prevent civil rights legislation from happening. And so you get some voting rights measures that are coming up, some other measures related to civil rights, and Southerners are starting to realize that this is, you know, as they become a smaller minority, and as civil rights takes higher and higher priority on the agenda, and non-Southerners start to realize that it's going to be difficult for them to not support civil rights measures, the Southerners realize that, okay, we're going to be in the minority on this, and this is really the what we're going to have to hang our hat on, that this tool is what we're going to have to use. But there's even disagreement among Southerners about what they should have been doing. Well, there are actually some interesting public opinion data that's available during the 1940s and 1950s when filibuster and cloture reform was being considered, much like it's being considered today. And back then, you had majorities who were in favor of reducing the cloture requirement to a simple majority. If you look at, you can break the data down by region, and you can even see that Southerners are opposed to the filibuster and are in favor of imposing majority cloture, reducing the cloture threshold from a supermajority to a simple majority. Now, I think early on, what this is really indicating is that Southerners in the electorate, not the elites, didn't realize how important the filibuster was going to be toward protecting the Southern way of life. And so elites sort of recognize this first, and then this perception trickles down to the public. Because you can look over time and see that there starts to be this regional divide in opinion about the filibuster and about supermajority procedure. So that Southerners eventually come around to saying, okay, yeah, this is something that we should maintain, that we shouldn't reduce the cloture threshold from a supermajority down to a majority.
I guess this hour, to give us a historical perspective of the filibuster, is Professor Gregory Warrow, Associate Professor of Political Science at Columbia University, co-author of Filibuster, Obstruction and Lawmaking in the United States Senate. Here's our phone number. A couple lines are open for you, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, the uses of artificial intelligence. They are widespread, and they've only just begun. Let's go to phone calls. Filibuster this hour, Clyde in Denmark, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. I'm an angry Democrat, and I'm not only angry at the Republicans for threatening to filibuster every bill, I'm almost more angry at the Democratic leadership for letting them get by with it. I think that they should make them filibuster one or two bills. The public would realize how stupid this whole thing was, and there would never be another filibuster unless it was a really important issue for a long, long time. They claim we wouldn't get anything done if you had them do real filibusters. We don't get anything done the way it is. So I think we really need to let them filibuster.
Professor Waru.
There are a lot of people out there who have exactly the same belief about the Senate and what Democrats should do. I'm a Congress scholar, and I have a lot of respect for the institution, unlike many other fellow Americans. And I do think that Congress does manage to get a lot done. A lot of things you don't see are important, you know, sort of day-to-day business to keep the country and the government running. They do get that stuff done. It's been a lot harder to get to do those sorts of things, to pass appropriations bills, pass budget bills, and those sorts of things. I think that if the problem with forcing filibusters, old-style filibusters where they take the floor, is basically I think the minority would win every time, because especially now, given the degree of polarization that exists between the parties, that it would be easy to just rotate individuals on and off the floor in the minority to wear the majority out. Maybe we should put this to the test. Maybe we should just say, okay, let's tie the Senate in knots. Let the minority do this. It will probably result in a government shutdown, and then we can see how the public reacts to that. If you look at some recent public opinion polls, what you see is that the public actually supports supermajority requirements in the Senate, unlike what we saw in the 1940s through the 1960s. There appear to be majorities who say that we should keep the supermajority requirements that currently exist in the Senate. Now that opinion might be changing given what has happened recently, but the public generally seems to like that there's balance, and they view, whether rightly or wrongly, that the filibuster is key to maintaining the balance that we see when we have things like divided government, when the Republicans and Democrats share control of government. So I'm not sure how the public would actually react to this, but that's really an important question, and that we might see an answer to as there are more attempts to try to reform filibusters and hold the minority's feet to the fire.
Isn't there, not that this is necessarily right, but isn't there also a strong idea in America that majority rules?
Certainly, but the question is, when you're in the minority, how much do you accept that? And that's an important piece of democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Is that when you're in the minority, or when you're in the majority and you lose your majority and get relegated to the minority, that you accept that? And it seems like we might be less willing to accept that, or at least among elites who might be less willing to accept that than we have been in the past.
Yeah. Here's an email that's come in from Donna. The filibuster rule gives our representatives license to play partisan politics with a spirit of non-cooperation. It seems counterproductive that our senators have to go into every vote with the assumption that the other side will try to block it, thereby necessitating a supermajority for passage. If election laws required 60% of the votes for a win, there would be a lot of empty offices.
That's true, and that's a very good point. I think that the email also raises an issue which is not talked about enough in debates about filibuster and cloture reform, is that this idea of what the culture is like among senators now, that they go into these debates thinking that they're going to have to fight tooth and nail with members of the opposite party. And I think that a lot of senators believe this currently, that what really needs to happen, maybe in conjunction with a rule change, is to try to change the culture, that there is this highly partisan atmosphere that exists in Washington, and this idea that there needs to be more cooperation, that senators need to spend more time with each other, that they need to realize that they may be opponents about particular issues, but they still have to work together to make American democracy work. And even though you might change the rules regarding filibusters and cloture, that you really aren't going to see changes until until you get a more cooperative spirit in Washington.
Well, that could be a long time coming.
Well, we used to have it, and I think you know this. I've listened to discussion among senators about how you might get back to that. You know, this talk about how senators used to know each other more.
Right.
They used to spend more time together. That they, you know, they used to go to their kids' sporting events together, and you know, coach their kids' sports teams and things like that. And that just doesn't happen these days. And I think it, you know, that relates to the point that we were talking about before, where you know the life of a senator in terms of how packed their personal schedules are, that you know they don't spend that much time in Washington compared to what they used to or they used to spend there, and I think that really there's a lot of it's pretty compelling that senators behave differently toward each other, and part of that has to do with this what has happened in terms of the changes in the culture and the perception that senators have about their jobs, their roles in Washington versus what they should be doing back in their states, and just the spirit of cooperation and willingness to realize that, okay, we are, you know, I'm in the minority, but, you know, there's a reason why I'm in the minority, and I have to accept that and figure out how I can effectively represent my constituents without just undercutting the Democratic legislative process of the Senate.
Thanks, Clyde, for the call. Hugh in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I want to speak up on behalf of the filibuster. I've not done a history of it, but it seems like around 1917, Senator La Follette of Wisconsin was involved in a filibuster when Wilson and the administrative Democrats wanted to push us into war. He did, as I recall, kind of slow us down. Unfortunately, from my point of view, we did get involved in a war where both the British and the Germans were interfering with American neutral rights. But I'm glad that some people did try to slow us down. Senator Huey Long in the 30s was a filibuster. Senator Wayne Morse, the maverick Republican who became a Democrat, was involved in filibuster. Even just a week or so ago, you have the socialist from New England who was filibustering. I think it's good that we have people who will filibuster. And when people got angry enough, and when people were willing to do it, they could override the filibuster, the civil rights law. Remember, it's almost all the Democrats, it was only Democrats who were really opposed to it. The Democrats opposed, a large portion of the Democratic Party was vehemently opposed to the civil rights legislation. But when Republicans and Democrats in the North got together, the Civil Rights Act was passed. The trouble now, I would say, is that many of the Democratic bills, when Pelosi says we pass Obamacare and then we find out what's in it. When some of the Democrats want to ignore the Constitution, like the Second Amendment, and pass bills restricting this and that, when one party wants to ignore the Constitution rather than amend it, then, of course, there is a real need for the filibuster.
Professor Wawru.
You make several valid points. A lot of times the framers of the Constitution are invoked when we talk about filibuster battles. You know, would the framers approve of this or not? The framers did not include supermajority requirements or for everything in Article 1 or specifically define where you needed supermajorities in the Constitution. But this cuts both ways, because the framers also put in Article 1 the statement that the Congress gets to determine its own rules of proceedings. And so if the Congress decides that it wants to operate by supermajority procedures, then you can make a claim that it's constitutional for it to do so. I think you can also make a compelling argument that one of the key themes in the Constitution is that to get anything done, to change policy at the federal level, you needed widespread agreement. You know, the fact that we have this separation of power system, which was unique at the time that the framers created it, required that you have widespread agreement across broad constituencies before any major change could take place. And so you could argue that the filibuster and supermajority requirements are in that spirit, that especially in a highly polarized atmosphere, that that it's better that you have supermajorities. You could even make an argument that sometimes the minority represents a majority of the country. There are cases that you can point to where the Republicans were in control of the Senate, and Democrats were in the minority, but yet, if you look at the populations in the states that the Democrats were representing, they were greater than the populations of the states that the Republicans were representing. And, you know, you have to look at particular ways that coalitions are breaking down. But there's you know, you can make a case for that. I think the problem really comes in when the when you don't have the, like I said, the spirit of cooperation that essentially everything is going to get filibustered. If you really want to make supermajority rule legitimate, then just let's make that explicit. Let's just say, okay, we have a, you know, let's make it explicit in the rules that we have a 60-vote Senate, and then in some sense, I think that makes it more legitimate. And then you can't have the majority saying, well, you know, the minority is using illegitimate tactics to prevent us from working the will of the people. You know, the filibuster is one of those issues where it really, as you said in your introduction, it really depends on whether you're in the majority or the minority,
right,
whether you like it or not. It's probably it's arguably the number one issue with respect to hypocrisy in American politics, with mm-hmm. respect to being on one side of the issue one day and being on,
exactly,
on the other side,
yeah,
of the issue another day.
Yeah. Thanks, Hugh, for the call. We go next to Kenneth in Milton. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello. They must have changed how filibusters are conducted, but it seems to me, I remember Senator Strom Thurmond as a Dixiecrat had to stay up there, and there were no bathroom breaks allowed, and I think he has the record for like 28 hours, but they did not allow anybody else to take the floor, and I think everybody had to listen. Everybody had to be in the Senate to where they had to listen for the speaker to read the phone book or whatever. And this kind of.
Do you want to fill us in on Thurmond's filibuster, Professor?
Sure. Your caller is correct that Strom Thurmond does have the record for the longest filibuster. It's just a little bit over 24 hours.
Wow.
How he actually pulled this off without taking bathroom breaks is it's a little bit unclear how he did that. But the context here, I think, is important, because what Thurmond was doing was filibustering the 1957 Civil Rights Act. And Lyndon Johnson had worked out a deal with other Southern Democrats where they weren't supposed to filibuster the 57 Civil Rights Act, that this was going to be one of the first Civil Rights Acts that was actually meaningful, actually had some meaningful reforms in it. And so the reason that Thurmond had to be up there for 24-plus hours was because he was grandstanding. His Southern colleagues had basically entered into an agreement that they weren't going to filibuster, and so he wasn't getting any help from his Southern colleagues. They weren't going to relieve him and conduct the filibuster while he went off and took a rest or got something to eat or whatever he needed to do. I think that's important in a couple respects. One, it shows that, well, you can work out compromises where people will restrain themselves from filibustering if necessary to get what they want. But the Thurmond filibuster is, it's one of the historic moments in the Senate, but it's often not well understood in terms of why it happened the way it did. He lost. The 57 Civil Rights Act passed. But had there not been this compromise and other senators had helped him and contributed to the filibuster, it's not likely that we would have seen the 57 Civil Rights Act passed in the form that it was passed in.
Thanks, Kenneth. Jake in Onalaska. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make the comment that I've been following particularly the lame duck very closely via Ezra Klein and the Rachel Maddow show. And what I've noticed is that due to the abuse of the filibuster. And there's an amazing graph that shows the sharp incline on Ezra Klein's blog at the Washington Post. But the only leverage that's left for the majority is that you can't go home for Christmas, basically. So I think it clearly the reason we haven't seen a budget passed and the reason they're going to have to start funding the government, you know, a few months at a time is because the filibuster is broken and no one's actually proposing to get rid of it. All they're proposing is to make sure that you can't filibuster in absentia and that you can't put anonymous holds on nominees. And that's all I have to say.
Okay, thanks for the call, Professor.
You're absolutely right that the thrust of the reform is not to basically say we're going to get rid of the filibuster, that we're going to go to majority cloture, which is something that the Senate has considered in the past. My take on this is basically that the senators want to reserve the option of filibustering for themselves when they find themselves in the minority. So when Bernie Sanders got up and filibustered, he was basically technically he's in the majority. He's an independent, but he caucuses with the Democrats. He's in the majority, but yet he's the one filibustering, right? Because he doesn't like what the compromise that the majority Democrats have entered into to extend the Bush tax cuts. And so I think that's really the core of why we are not seeing more serious effort to get rid of the filibuster. I have no doubt that if there was a majority that was firm in its support of eliminating the filibuster or going to majority cloture, that they could do it. Right? They could do the constitutional option or the nuclear option. The Senate actually already did that back in 1975 and then reversed itself. So it's there's no doubt in my mind that they could do this if they really wanted to. But I just do not see the existence of a committed majority who's ready to get rid of the filibuster or move to majority cloture. Now, Democrats are looking at things a lot differently now than they were 2 years ago, when they were 59 votes and then later got to 60 votes, because they have a much smaller majority. And if you look at the electoral landscape for the next election, it does not look good for Democrats in the Senate. Maybe they'll rebound. Maybe the economy will come back and there'll be a favorable wave for Democrats. But right now, I think that the Democrats are going to have a tough time keeping their majority in the Senate, which means that they're going to be the ones in a position to want to use the filibuster more in the Congress after the current one, and so I think that there is that hesitancy. The senators are there for 6 years. They're there for 4 years longer than House members. They have a longer term view of themselves and what they want to do as senators, and they realize a lot of them realize and have experience being in the minority. And they know how important it is to have the leverage of the filibuster in order to prevent certain things from getting passed. This point about the only leverage that the majority has is that people want to go home for Christmas. I've written that I don't think that keeping the Senate in session is really the solution to this. But given how problematic the filibuster has become, I've come around to the idea that, yeah, okay, maybe we should try this. It looked like healthcare reform was passed, even though the minority could have obstructed it if they had wanted to stay through Christmas, but they didn't want to do that, right? So maybe we should hold the minority's feet to the fire a little bit more. I don't think it would work, but at this point, I think that the majority should be willing to try anything.
Well, what about the lame duck session? Is that an indication that spirit of cooperation, let's get together and listen to each other's ideas and be helpful to each other, has begun?
That's a really good question. I would like to think that that's the case, but the trend in polarization is so stark that it's going to take a lot to reverse that. And I think you need to look at what the deeper causes of this are. and you need to address those before you can really get back to some sort of spirit of cooperation. But I do think that that there are certain things that senators could do, at least cosmetically, to move beyond the tuperative debate that happened in the last Senate. Just the Democrats doing things like filling the amendment tree, which Republicans have become really irate about. That basically that this is a violation of one of the fundamental tenets of the Senate is that the minority gets its say, right? The minority has an opportunity to shape legislation, unlike what goes on in the House of Representatives. And that, basically the Republicans were saying, well, the reason that we have been filibustering so much is because the Democrats have been limiting our participation in the legislative process to such a degree that we have no other choice,
mm-hmm.
that they are forcing our hand. So, the reason the Democrats are filling the amendment tree is because they don't want to allow Republicans to force them to vote on embarrassing issues like Viagra for sex offenders.
Right.
And so. This is the kind of thing like the Democrats do something that offend the Republicans and the Republicans hit back and the Democrats feel like they need to hit back, and this idea that you need to stop this back and forth tit for tat conflict is you need to do something to try to move beyond that, and I think we did see some of that in the lame duck session. But I think that senators start to do more. They have to do more in the respect of just like standing up and saying, "Okay, look, we're not going to take cheap political shots at our opponents, right? That we're going to try to move beyond a little bit of that." And if that happens, then I think you'll see a break in this cycle where the parties just go at each other tooth and nail and look for every little political advantage, no matter how small, yes. Get it on Fox News or whatever to try to undercut your opponent. I think if we can move beyond that, then I think that can go a fairly large degree toward ending the this culture of conflict that currently exists in the Senate.
The filibuster is what we're talking about this hour of the program. The new Senate is debating changing the rules regarding filibusters, and we're looking at their history and how much have they been used the last 2 years and the 8 years before that, and historically how they came about and how they've been used through history in the 20th century. Our guest is Professor Gregory Warrow. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at Columbia University, author of Filibuster, Obstruction and Lawmaking in the United States Senate. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email address, talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, we will be talking about artificial intelligence. We go back to phone calls. Pat is next in Brookfield. Hi, Pat.
Hey, guys. The guest just kind of stole my thunder there a little bit, but he made the point that I wanted to make. It seems on one hand, the majority party, they don't necessarily want the filibuster, but yet they won't allow the minority party to really bring any legislation to the table. So it seems like the minority party is forced into playing defense, and I guess on major legislation, even if we just look at the health care bill, the public option was probably something that Democrats could have gotten through, with 51, 52, 53 votes. And if you looked at just the mood of the country in every national poll you saw, there wasn't support among the people for a public option. There wasn't even a majority of support among the people in many polls I saw just for the health care legislation we got passed. And I think when you're debating legislation as big as health care or stimulus, for example, either you need to have the 60 votes since the country is so divided, or if you get rid of the filibuster, I think they should make some type of rule of you have to have some of the minority party sign on, whether it be 2, 3, 4, or 5 senators from the minority party. I just think that's the best way to represent the country versus just having a straight majority vote.
Okay, Professor Warrow.
If you look at the passage of significant legislation throughout the 20th century, One thing that you see is that there are overwhelming majorities in the Senate in favor of that legislation. We're talking coalitions that are, you know, we're talking about, you know, that get 80, 90 votes. That has changed in the sense of it's a lot harder now to get legislation that has those kind of majorities. But it seemed to be that senators agreed with that sentiment that you do need widespread support for legislation of that kind of magnitude before you should move forward with it. The problem is that the country now, or at least at the elite level, is so highly polarized that it's really hard to reach across the aisle and get individuals to vote with you. Part of that has to do with general trends in American politics. And, you know, that's kind of the $64,000 question, is how did we get to this state of polarization? And there's been a lot of really good work that's been done on that. But I think where we are at this point now is this concern that bipartisanship, while generally people seem to think it's a good thing, that acting in a bipartisan manner is almost viewed as giving way too much to your opponent, so that if you vote with the Democrats, that somehow that makes you look weak, that gives them a political victory if they pick up Republican votes. And so in some sense, it seems like a lot of what happens with a lot of legislation, a lot of significant legislation, is that the minority votes against the majority just for the sake of voting against them, because they don't want to give them the sense of legitimacy that they have that there's bipartisan support for something. I think the you know, there is an incentive for the majority to form bipartisan coalitions apart from just the need to meet supermajority thresholds, in the sense that the majority likes political cover. You know, they like that when they pass something that they have support from the minority. So if things go badly with whatever they pass, that they can say, well, this is something that we had broad agreement on. Mm-hmm. This is something of both parties, and they can't be tagged as being, you know, and especially for the next election, as being the party that failed in some sense to pass legislation that was worthwhile.
Thanks, Pat, for the call. Mike in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. You know, quick comments. And then my main point, the first comment is that it all boils down to money. Everything the guest has talked about is, as long as we don't have realistic campaign finance reform and so forth, we are always going to have a tie to the party bosses or to the outside sources that are funding them, and you're not going to have senators socializing together because they're out shaking the trees for money the whole time. Now, as far as the main point I wanted to get to is that it's the other thing besides money is sunshine. Transparency.
Okay.
To what's really going on in the political process. And the old school filibuster, there was at least one component. In order to maintain that filibuster, you either had to have a bladder the size of a beach ball, or you had to have friends that are willing to stand up and be recognized and make a speech in favor of that particular block that you were doing. Now, imagine if on a lot of these, what I'll call knuckleheaded filibusters that we have now under the new way of doing things, that if each of these senators had to stand up in the well of the Senate and defend why they are supporting that particular blockage, then, you know, you're going to have hometown newspapers reporting on it. You're going to have congressional records. What I would like to see, if we can't have it go back to the old school, then let's put some sunshine on it. Let's put it on ussenate.gov front page, a link that goes directly to here's who's blocking what, and here's the people that are, you know, here's why they're blocking it, whatever. Their whole justification needs to be on there, needs to be on a federal website, can't be on.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're almost out of time here. That strikes me as reasonable. What do you say, Professor?
I agree. I think that there is a big problem in terms of the lack of transparency with a lot of what happens with filibusters, especially with holds. You know, the holds do not appear anywhere in the official Senate rulebook. It's just a practice that has evolved over time. And even if holds aren't unilateral vetoes, I think the perception that somehow that this is illegitimate, it permeates throughout the public. And so one way to address that is basically, okay, well, let's say in the Senate rulebook what it takes to put a hold. Let's advertise
right.
who is putting publicize who's putting holds on legislation, and let the public decide whether or not this is something that they
right.
agree with or disagree
right.
with.
It should be transparent. Oh, we have a ton of emails and good ones we never got to, and many phone calls. There's a deep interest in this topic here in Wisconsin, and we'll send you the emails in case you want to respond to them. There are a couple we didn't get to. Thank you so much, Professor Warrow, for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Our guest this hour, Professor Gregory Warrow, Associate Professor of Political Science at Columbia University. His book is, he's written several of them, but pertinent to our conversation, Filibuster, Obstruction and Lawmaking in the United States Senate. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks for all of your engaged participation in this particular hour's conversation. It was good. News coming up, we'll return with more Wednesday conversation.